Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Opera Talks. With me is Kirk Dougherty, who is singing Rodolfo in La Boheme. La Boheme is going to open on this coming Saturday, the 15th of April. And we're having only 6 performances, so if you want to see it, you have to get down there in a hurry because we're going to close by the end of the month on April 30th. By the way, we are open for performance on Easter Sunday, so if you're looking for something to do at 3 o'clock on Easter Sunday, come watch La Boheme.
Excellent.
Okay, so first of all, Kirk, you've been here 3 years.
Yes.
For a couple of those years, you were away for at least one show.
That's right, yeah.
But you've done a lot of roles here.
Yeah, this will be my 10th production here.
Yeah, 10.
Wow.
So
Time flies. Yeah.
And I have a feeling that some of these things will be useful to you in the future, and in particular,
absolutely,
Edgardo.
Oh, I think so too. So yeah, absolutely.
What are you looking at? What do you have in your pocket now that you think would really be of use in the future?
Well, I will be doing a Rigoletto soon, actually.
Oh, there you
and
go. Your
so,
first
yeah,
role here.
The first role here. And I'll be singing the Duke in Rigoletto at Opera Las Vegas in a few weeks. Later May is the production period into June. So, you know, we're really looking forward to that. And I'm singing Madama Butterfly at another place. I can't quite say it because we're
not
kind of
settled,
finishing
yeah.
up the contract.
Yeah.
And looking forward to that. I'm singing Pinkerton in later September. And beyond that, I've got a couple of concerts to do. This the Ninth Symphony somewhere and a couple of other concerts.
I really think Concert Rep.
Oh, it's
magical.
The great thing about Concert Rep is you're not on the road for quite as long as the production period of an opera. And so
yeah,
it's
not even half.
Less time intensive. Yes, definitely. Though I've done many an opera production period in a short kind of time frame, and that can be stressful. But
I hope that's
sometimes
over. I hope you never have to do that again.
I do. Yes, I agree, because those are really tough. But places that produce such things, they don't have as long a run of their performances, but they also don't have as long a time to prepare the production. And in today's world, with less time for many things, if you can have great rehearsal time and great rehearsal period with the cast, that makes for a great show.
Especially in these days where acting on stage,
oh, it's gigantically important.
It's supposed to equal that of acting on the silver screen.
Exactly.
They're expecting close-ups, right? And some companies actually are giving close-ups because they have TV monitors hanging around and they give them close-ups.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's a whole different creature.
Yeah, it's a kind of it's a new kind of art in a way, because the medium has changed a lot, and even the process of performing the live performance, I believe, is different as well. But the nature of how to present a character changes when you have this extra bit of time, because you can present not just your individual character, but the relationships to the other characters. And I think that's been an important part of our process, specifically even in La Boheme, to make an interesting set of relationships between the presented characters. And I think that's new. It's less new, certainly, for stage and screen, but it's definitely even a part of producing opera now, too, is to define the relationships between all the characters.
I can't imagine opera produced in a shorter time frame than we do.
No.
By the way, that's come up in the other podcasts with other singers.
Yeah.
That the amount of time Opera San Jose spends in rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
I would just really not like to do it in less time.
No, it's true. And it's also not necessarily the hour intensity of each daily, because daily I don't think we ever spend more than 6 hours day.
That's right.
In production.
No, it's not what you do in a single day. That's not.
No, it's the span of days. And so I think, hour upon hour, there's no more than two rehearsal sessions in any day, but the stream of days is longer.
And there are some things that just have to mellow in the pot.
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
I think the understanding of an opera role, because there's so many different things to understand,
mm-hmm.
it's not like an acting role.
No, no.
It's a different creature. Right. Yeah. So the what you have to sing has to settle into the throat, settle into into the way you do things.
Yep.
Also, every role is different. It asks for something a little harder here, a little harder there. You have to learn how to pace so that you can get through those stretches where you really do have vocal challenges. Normally, it's extremes of range, right?
Yep.
Suddenly you discover that somebody asked you to sing in the upper four notes of your range, and this leave you there.
Extremes of range, extremes of intensity, how loud or how soft something is, extremes of duration,
and what
sentences.
What?
Yes, the progression of emotions.
Because composers don't really understand what should follow what. Back in the days of Verdi and Mozart, they all knew what could follow. Well, not Mozart for tenors.
No, no, that's true. Actually, that's true. No, he was not a big tenor writer. No.
Well, it was a whole different instrument.
That's right.
From ours, but
vocal technique was different. Yeah. But definitely the progression of let's take La Bohème for instance. The progression of acts. We just did our Sitzprobe, which basically is a sitting rehearsal with an orchestra and musicians in the pit and singers up on stage, and we basically rehearse the music in a reading with all of the orchestra, and we. In order to release some of our children's chorus and our other chorus members, typically you start with the biggest numbers first. And sometimes, you know, you notice these things in something like that, like even the progression of acts and how one is rehearsed in the process can inform you vocally, like how difficult it is from Act 1, Scene 1 to Act 4, Scene 2, how to progress with a voice. If you started at Act 2 and then went to Act 3 and then, say, went back to Act 1 to 4, the pacing is very different and sometimes a lot easier, actually. And I found that last night as I was sitting there thinking about that rehearsal process. And little things like that, that's something unique to opera because the vocal demands are so great. I don't know. It's that... Also, the progression of emotions throughout time. A sentence in opera takes so long to express because underneath the syllables of each word is a kind of melody through time to which the actor doesn't have complete control over because he's in the time of a musical number.
No control.
Very little, yeah. I mean, I would say almost, venture to guess no control.
Yeah,
no because control. Maybe you might, once everything stops, you might have an agreement with a conductor or director to commence on a certain action or something on stage. But other than that, you really don't have particular control over any of these moments that are led through by music and a conductor. So that's got to be different compared to acting, straight acting.
As you know, I used to be married to a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
He looked at opera singers as... not actors in any way possible.
No, and I think,
because they don't have to make any of the decisions an actor has to make.
Exactly.
The composer made all those decisions.
Yes, so it does limit your control over certain decisions. However, you still have to execute those decisions, and the execution of decisions is really the part that takes the most time. Oh, grab the plate here, put the dishes there, move the set this way. Many of these numbers are what sets up the more mundane moving around of things, the more mundane way of the Bohemians living together sets up some of the more sublime telling of story in the later acts with the ensemble and with the Mimi and Rodolfo character, with the Musetta Marcello character and their relationships. We try to make a world that has lots of color and vibrancy, and then... slowly over time is reduced and it dissipates into just the life and death relationships between these individuals.
I have been discovering a whole new side of Bohème. Here, I'm 67 years old. and I've, how many times have I sat through La Bohème and in how many places? It was the first opera I ever saw at the Met with Corelli singing Rodolfo.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I was a teenager, right?
Iconic.
A lot has gone by. Things in my own life have caused me to see things in the opera with much more clarity than before. As you know, I'm also a widower.
Yeah.
So,
of course.
Coming to terms with that, seeing, I mean, the very opera we did right after
Silent Night.
No. Right after Bruce died.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
The next opera was La Boheme.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Don de Lieta came right off the page.
Yes.
I'd never really liked that aria before. It was, could she please
absolutely
get over this?
Absolutely right, yes.
I don't really like breakups. Could this be over with? Mm-hmm. And I was a mess. I was just a
of
mess.
Of course.
But
you bring up a good point, though, that the audience is often informed within the story by their own, what they bring to the life. Yeah.
Your own life changes how you see everything you look at. And of course, when an opera then overlaps with your own experience, and this opera overlaps with many people's experiences.
Yes.
And it's not about the death. The thing that I've come to realize is this is about the happiest opera I have ever experienced.
Yes, that's right. Yes. That's something, yeah.
All the way through. It's so happy.
That's right.
And
yeah.
You whistle it, you keep it in your head, and it makes you grin, it makes you smile.
Right.
And yet, it's one of the cruelest of operas.
Because it happens
so
fast at
the end. Because you love these people so much, and this devastation that happens right at the tail end. It's only at the very tail end, but there it is. And it's genuine devastation, and catches them all off guard. They're not prepared for it. They don't think 1 minute into the future.
No, the idea of something palliative to soften this experience, you know, of her dying is, it's just not a part of their own way of life. So
can't even conceive of it.
May not have even been invented at the time, actually, a palliative care kind of process that was formalized that we present now. I don't even know if that was
they had places
really
where you
a part.
Went to die. If you've read de Murger, Saint de la Vie de Bohème, right?
Yes.
So if you've read that thing, then you'll recognize where Mimi actually died was in one of the public hospitals. I think the Hôtel Dieu was just a public hospital where people literally went to die.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough, though. I don't know if we would do that now. I think there's a more enlightened way of doing things now.
If you have the money.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I found interesting about this was just how important it is to play the death and the progression of sadness in coming to terms with the, you know, this, making that something. Don't play the moment too early. You have to really keep to the love and the happiness. Exactly. Every single moment. And it's very important not to get too sad in these moments prior to that actual moment. That's the key thing to doing it, because, you know, you really have to do every moment in the present.
Yeah, so, precisely.
Yeah.
That'll be true in anything you ever do.
Yes, but
you have to live in the present.
How many La Bohèmes, though, have I seen, though, where people are really weepy way too early in it?
How many La Bohèmes have I seen where people were just phoning it in?
Yes, the other thing, it's the most performed opera in the history of opera, probably.
Well, it's certainly right now the most performed opera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of
number one on every world, I forget which internet source, I think Opera Base. It's the number one.
It is now. It hadn't always been, but it is at the moment. It is the most performed opera. But do you realize the most performed operas are all attributed to only three men?
Yes. This is
Mozart, Verdi, and Puccini.
Yeah.
And realizing that Verdi gave us, 29 operas?
Mm-hmm.
Puccini, if you count Tritico as only one instead of three,
mm-hmm.
he only gave us 10.
Yeah.
10 operas, that's all he gave us.
And
he's still up there with the most performances in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
But you
history.
Know what? Even more profound than, I guess I should say, Mozart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has really only given us 5.
Yeah.
The three da Ponte operas, Magic Flute, and Abduction from the Seraglio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's about all you get out of Mozart. And still he reigns in the top three most performed composers in the world.
When you think about it, even more than that, probably the librettists. Maybe one or two main sources then, probably. What was Da Ponte and Schikaneder?
Schikaneder for Magic Flute.
And Abduction was Schikaneder?
No, Magic Flute was Schikaneder.
Yeah.
And let's see. The last one was a rewrite of Metastasio.
Yes. Yeah, Metastasio. No,
Clemenza di Tito, which nobody does.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, anyway.
Not as much as it used to. There's a couple.
A lot of operas have fallen by the wayside.
Yes. Yes, they go in and out of fashion.
In 30 years,
mm-hmm.
when I was first coming, La Gioconda was a big deal opera.
Yeah, you hardly ever see that now.
I haven't seen anybody do it in the United States in years.
Yeah.
But it was done.
Mm-hmm.
There were many operas that were done with great regularity, and now they're sort of being pushed aside. Verdier mm-hmm. was something that was absolute standard rep. You were going to do it all the time in San Jose.
That's interesting to me.
We almost
yeah.
dare not do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have Butterfly, The Barber of Seville,
yes.
and La Boheme, and then you can do...
Yes, maybe the second, you know...
Onegin. Manon, yeah. the Massenet Manon,
mm-hmm.
and
oh Manon, yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. it's wonderful.
Yeah,
but people just will not come and watch it.
No, that is true. Or Gounod's Faust over Romeo and Juliet. Yeah, they do the primary work, and then perhaps the secondary work as much.
It used to be that Faust was performed a lot, Romeo and Juliet not so much. I don't know what mm-hmm. it is now.
Yeah, well, sometimes. Yeah, it is really hard to say what it is that makes an opera go in or out of fashion, but maybe the changing times, the political landscape, the things that, you know,
changed
in the world.
That Americans have a different set of favorite operas from Europeans.
Yeah, I bet that's true.
And I think Americans need a hero.
Mm-hmm.
They need somebody who's brave, true, will die for you, will die for the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And their character is absolutely immovably firm.
Maybe absolute characters versus ambiguous characters. Yeah.
More clarity.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
we get
Europeans
Cho-Cho
different.
San mm-hmm. is beloved. Violetta mm-hmm. is beloved.
Yeah.
Mimi is beloved, but she doesn't have those qualities. But
that's different. Yeah.
All of them are true to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In Bohème, just everybody is true to himself, and that's the whole meaning behind the Bohemian movement.
Right,
is just like the hippie movement, just like the beat movement.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah, to live that kind of lifestyle, even in 1840s Paris, right? In the original setting of the opera, yeah, that takes still like, you know, casting aside a lot of other normal ambitions of life.
The Bohemian movement can be thanked for a great many things, and in particular in the United States. There are wonderful books about the Bohemians and the movements and the American Bohemians. Once people discovered that the Bohemian movement existed in this country, they discovered that it was happening in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And in Italy, Puccini was among them, the Scapigliati,
sure,
the disheveled.
Yeah. Right?
And in the United States, they discovered this, and the center turned out to be in Greenwich Village because the rents were cheap.
Yeah.
And you could go there and rent an artist studio and sleep in it, and nobody cared, and you could do your work with very little money.
Yep.
So it became a magnet for Bohemians across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the cultural center of the United States shifted from Philadelphia to New York
mm-hmm.
because of the Bohemians. And this is the coolest thing. For the first time in the history of the United States, and it was about the 1860s, I believe, a woman could walk into a restaurant alone, be seated, order a meal, eat it, pay for it, and leave.
Oh, wow.
A woman could not do that before. Mm-hmm. She would not be seated. If she came into a restaurant alone, she would mm-hmm. not be seated. If she came into a bar alone, she would not be seated.
In the 1860s.
18.
Yeah.
Did I say 19?
No, I was
18,
making sure, yeah.
Yeah, but that was now possible in Greenwich Village because a woman could earn a living.
Yes, yeah.
She was not a prostitute looking for business.
Mm-hmm.
That was the problem. Oh, an unaccompanied woman was presumed to be a prostitute looking for business.
Wow.
And so she would be shown the door. She wouldn't be seated. But now women could write books. They could do art.
Mm-hmm.
They could publish and sell all manner of things. They could illustrate children's books and all manner
exactly.
of stuff. And they could literally earn a living, pay their rent, have money mm-hmm. to spend, and not be suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first time in America, a woman could be served dinner and alone.
Wow.
I think that's astonishing.
Yeah.
We take it so for granted
mm-hmm.
that it would just be impossible to conceive that a woman could walk into any place and not be served.
Yeah.
But it was the standard just a little more than 100 years ago.
Yeah, it is. It's a weird the progression of history and what things come in and out of fashion. It definitely has a lot to do with our tastes at the time.
Cultural mores.
Yeah,
that's a big deal.
But La Bohème, I don't know if it's ever found itself in, on the losing side of that. I mean, I think it's always been the one piece that seems to have been
it's
around.
It's barely grown in popularity.
Yeah, and usually that's not the case with things.
You see, Carmen was the most performed opera in the United States not long ago.
Yes, I had heard that. This is, yeah.
And Butterfly has always been in the top, but Carmen was always on top.
Wow.
And Butterfly was after Carmen, and then you got to La Bohème. If you didn't get to Don Giovanni before you got to La Bohème.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, Don Giovanni.
But I mean, La Bohème has been climbing to the very top.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Amazing what can happen in a span of 20, 30 years, two generations. You'll find things, you know.
I'll tell you what scares me. New work.
Yeah.
When you stop to think, the three people who are keeping opera in business have been dead since the most recent death. It's 1924.
Yeah.
That's a long time. That's almost 100 years right now.
Yeah.
And nothing has come in. There's nothing between. And that's nervous making.
No, that is. And it's funny about it, too, because the other thing I was thinking of in this past season, especially here at Opera San Jose, is what makes these shows so interesting to people, especially maybe these last few. I'm thinking specifically of Silent Night. Was when we got to Silent Night and performed that, I would talk to the patrons after occasionally, and they would not always mention this about acting or singing, but about what they brought from their own life. Again, going back to what you're saying, and they had the one patron had talked to me about a relative, an ancestor who'd served in the Black Watch during that time, and you know, the conversations tended to move towards things of their own personal nature. And I think the best operas, at least when they were first being done, it's something I bet they had a certain amount of personal attachment to each audience member, and I think that's one of the things in great storytelling and then in great musical composing. If we want to make better opera, new opera, we should try to focus our efforts on bringing the audience to the work by giving them something to talk about like this after. Not just the singers and who's great or who's
that. Involve their concerns.
Yes, involve their concerns. Or the concerns of someone from their past or something on their mind. The political situation that has changed so much, I think that contributed maybe to that discussion too.
I'll tell you, things were very alive.
Yes, in the last few months.
December,
right.
And January and February, things were very alive, and people were very, very much caught up in concerns about government and about war and peace, so to speak. As you know, we were all, you and I included, we were all preparing and researching about World War One.
Yes.
And to be researching The Fall of Eagles and all those great books and novels and documentaries about what was going on that led us to this World War One, during a presidential campaign that was so revealing. It was the most revealing campaign in my lifetime. There was never anything quite like it.
Important centennial.
Yeah.
It's been
the centennial of our entrance into that war.
Yeah.
All that
concatenation
stuff going on,
of things.
It just felt so immediate. And I've never been a guy who really cared about politics.
Nope.
And I've never studied war, never.
No, and it's funny about that because that's sort of the Western approach to a lot of art making is that you're certainly not involved in the political, you're commenting from a distance, I think, or observing from a distance the political world of in which you inhabit.
One of my favorite examples of that is Fidelio.
Yeah.
When Fidelio had its world premiere, who saw it? a whole bunch of French military officers.
Mm-hmm.
That's who came to the first performance of Fidelio, because they had invaded Vienna and all the Germans had run off, right? So we had all these French guys attending. Well, guess what those French guys had just lived through?
Mm-hmm.
The terror.
Yeah.
So they knew exactly how dangerous it was to be picked up off the street and put into a prison.
Mm-hmm.
They knew exactly how terrifying that was. And so they're sitting in the room knowing that this dude is done for.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman who's come in here to get him out is done for. And that they triumph at the end, that the right people come, the king's people come and get Pizarro out of the way and set everybody free.
Yeah.
When I saw it in Santa Fe, it was Stephen Wadsworth's production, and it was set in Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And it was the British who arrived and set those people free. And it was over the top. And for the first time for me, that over the top joyous music that Beethoven put at the end, it's a lot of music there at the end. It just keeps getting, you know, how Beethoven does.
Yeah, of course.
And
I've seen the right metaphor.
I wish he could take some Quaaludes and calm down a little bit. But instead, I was right there with him.
Yeah.
Because it was Nazis.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so the metaphor seemed to fit the mood.
Just me in the teeth.
Yeah.
Absolutely unforgettable for me. Unforgettable. Other people, however, felt ill from watching it. They physically felt ill.
Yeah.
Because it was too powerful for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were hard.
Bringing their personal, their own personal experience to their informs their viewing.
That long ago.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that too. Yeah, there's much of a balance, I guess. You know, finding what an audience can bring to the work personally.
But I think the days of people just wanting to sit back and hear the music are over.
No, that's true. I mean, it can be great, and it's a wonderful. It's absolutely, having done this Itzprobe last night. I mean, I forgot how wonderfully orchestrated La Bohème is.
The guy's a genius.
Yes, yes. It takes many. Many other sides to a great production, but I should send a plug in for the orchestra because I have never heard such excellent playing.
I was there for the first read through.
It was beautiful.
And Joe was being Joseph Marchese,
yes.
The music director who was conducting, was being very meticulous about every tiny little dot in that score.
Yes,
and making sure everybody was really on top of all the dynamics.
Yes, really, really subtle playing
on the score, and man, that changes everything.
Yeah,
there's a way to just saw through.
A familiar Bohème.
Yeah.
Again, because it is really a familiar work to all involved in opera producing. It's iconic, but I think it's just a great piece of music as well, because they really. I can't think of a time I'd heard them play to better effect. It was really great music making.
They had such a good time with Silent Night.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
That really
they enjoyed that too.
You know, they were all really worried about it, but then they discovered that it was so idiomatically composed for each of their own instruments.
Yes, and the story. They were interested in our story too. I found that really remarkable. Well, the movie music of that. Was palpable as much as the style writing was.
Oh, are you talking about the Joyeux Noël?
Kevin Putz's score. There's certain cinematic quality
it
to
does,
it.
Yes, indeed.
But then there's the style writing quality as well. And he does that very well. In the same way, I think Puccini has that way of producing music that is very funny. There's some funny little riffs in La Bohème that you can hear it in a rehearsal repetitor piano score.
But you don't hear it till you.
But you don't hear it as comical until you hear it with all the orchestration, and so there that joyousness.
We are kind of unique in our line of work because we get to hear the orchestra without singers.
Yeah. Yes.
And they're not down in a hole under the stage. They're right there in front of us, and we get to hear them just performing.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet audiences would enjoy. Would very much enjoy hearing Zitzprobas.
I think so too.
You hear this whole different animal. It's
it's almost a radio play, but with an entire orchestra and a cast of many scores of chorus and children's chorus. I mean, it's they really enjoyed it. I can tell also when an orchestral read like that in a sitting rehearsals, its proba is done well, is that everybody has a kind of a levity to it, because let's face it, when you don't need to coordinate every element of production, lights and costumes, it's so much easier. We can relax and be musicians and singers together.
That's one of the reasons that we so carefully step forward through the process.
Right.
We spend a long time here just mm-hmm. with music, a whole week just with the music.
Yeah.
And then we spend 3 weeks and a little more than that, at minimum 18 days of staging rehearsals with the acting and a piano. Then
yeah.
When we go to the theater, we feed it all in a little bit at a time. The Zitzprobe mm-hmm. is going to come. More technical rehearsals are going to come. The costumes
makeup,
then arrive. Then the wigs and makeup arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And then you actually perform acting with the orchestra step by step. So you can grow accustomed to each of those things that get added mm-hmm. on. Baby steps. Instead of just arriving first day in the theater, costumes, wigs, makeup, done out there with an orchestra in the pit, which is how it used to be.
Yeah, you know, that's the other thing. A lot of in earlier generations of singers, you would have a production style that was so rigorous to the score, but also to the demands of the production, that the singers could come with their own costumes.
Yeah, they did bring their own costumes. They couldn't come.
They
must come.
Yeah, I suppose, yes. And they would have to bring their own costumes, of course.
Opera company wasn't going to pay for costumes.
No, interesting. So they would bring their own. When you see some, occasionally I've seen a couple, you know, oh, this is so-and-so's costume from this production, that production.
Irene had costumes of her own mm-hmm. that she wore at the Met.
Yeah, so it wasn't that far back in the past.
That was the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Irene began at the Met in 57.
Wow.
And she mm-hmm. still had her own costumes made for Omneris.
Mm-hmm.
She had a golden cloak, I don't know what to call it, cloak with a train.
Mm-hmm.
It was gold metal,
mm-hmm.
and it was long, mm-hmm. and it was in wonderful sort of plaited strips. Mm-hmm. It was a great thing. And then she pulled those things out of the attic, and we used them for Amal and the Night Visitors for their three kings.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah, we trashed them. We totally trashed those
person.
Things that she
She's
had worn
great.
As Omneris all over the world and ruined them in one production.
That's great. What a giving person. She's really, really remarkable. I mean, the entire process of doing things has changed quite a bit, I guess, over the years. But
sure. From the beginning, when our annual budget was $650,000.
Wow. Yeah.
That was the first year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it changed a lot.
there are many places like this in America now that are developing, you know, with some of the similar ideas and similar models as this place, but I don't think they were started in so far back. I think they're only beginning now.
Well, I know that there's a place, Aaron Nicholson, who is a baritone who now works
Yes, of course.
Adult.
Yeah.
He was at was it called Tri-Cities?
Yeah, Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton, that's right.
Yeah, and evidently that's kind of a resident company.
Mm-hmm. That's a resident place, yeah.
But they go there and they pay to go there, right? Because they study?
Yeah, they have some students from the university there that are singers as well. But there is a resident group of people.
They get paid to perform.
Yes, yeah. And I think they actually do. Yeah, I think they do have a contract with them. They at some point or another, they were in an AGMA house, and I think they may still be.
Okay, a whole different animal.
But Aaron also, you know, I think he has a company that is in Idaho.
Coeur d'Alene.
Opera Coeur d'Alene, yeah. And I remember, seeing something a friend of mine had sung there. And so places are doing some remarkable things in regional opera, many different venues across the U.S., Yeah, the opera world has changed a lot in even 30 years. The opening of the East, certainly in Germany and Austria, is different too.
Well, 60 years ago,
yeah,
there were only two opera houses in America that were producing
exactly.
opera:
yep.
the Met and San Francisco.
Yeah.
Now, 30 years before that, there were hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Depression knocked them out.
Yeah.
So the Met was the last man standing. And then mm-hmm. San Francisco was actually formed during the Great Depression.
Ah, mm-hmm.
So they had their birth during the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was San Francisco, and that was it. And if you didn't live there, you didn't see live opera.
Mm-hmm.
You could hear the Met on the radio.
Chicago is later too then.
They were, yeah, in the late '50s, early '60s is when Chicago, Carol Fox, I think her name was, started a real company, a producing company in Chicago. But the big company that had been there, for which that enormous opera house was constructed, that wonderful Art Deco.
That was the start of Franco Corelli, I think. That was one of his first gigs, I think.
I don't have a clue. There.
Yeah. Speaking of Franco Corelli from before. Yeah.
Oh, he was my hero.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt.
Just really.
No doubt.
Of course, the singer that I worshipped was Nicolai Guetta.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
a person who had just passed away
last few months ago. Yeah, yes. Wonderful voice, and the most recorded tenor possibly of all time.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I think that was true as of the 1990s.
Really?
It was, yeah.
Because it was just such a
amazing voice, versatility, fantastic, fantastic tone.
Had a terrific technique.
Oh, amazing.
But I, for some reason... Well, Nicolai Guetta spoke to me more clearly.
Mastered all styles, all national styles of opera singing. French, he could be a great French tenor, a great Italian tenor, a great German tenor.
They thought I was going to be singing stuff like Alfredo Kraus.
Oh yeah,
that's what
another
thought I was going to be doing. I didn't really like Alfredo Kraus's singing very much.
No, he was a widely recorded singer as well, but because he lived so long.
Yeah, I was hearing him toward the end of his life. I'm sure. Couldn't figure out why a man in his 70s was singing Romeo.
Amazing. You know? Yes, amazing. He could do that. Amazing he could do that.
Yeah, well, he couldn't. I was in the room.
Yeah. You know, he was a real icon. He was a real icon for a long time.
It was amazing he got paid to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it, amazing job.
He should have been playing her granddaddy.
It would, yes. Yeah, I could understand that.
I prefer a Romeo who looks about 16. Give him a choice.
Of course.
Not 60. I would want to see
really
me out there singing
Romeo. Yeah,
he
had a wonderful, an amazingly, youthful quality. But so did Guetta. I mean, I think he sang... Really, up until the 1980s and 90s, I think Nicolai Guetta.
He was on stage at New York at the big commemorative concerts that they were doing at the Met. He was on stage singing brilliantly.
Yeah.
But he didn't sing roles anymore.
No, okay. Yeah, amazing. There's a recording of him singing Le Postillon de Jean Jumeau, speaking of like very less known operas.
From?
Le Postillon du Long Jumeau? I think it is Le Postillon du Long Jumeau.
Is that Massenet?
Adolphe Adam.
I never heard of this.
this is like a famous tenor aria that has a high D in it. That's really most people will know of this opera, but
have to be tenors to know it.
It is one of those. Yeah, if you ever YouTube such a thing, you can see Le Postillon du Long Jumeau and hear the TV film version. Another thing they were doing with the versatile voices like Guetta was making the film and television versions of many operas and operettas. I think this is an operetta. Amazing.
Another reason I would.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to be a real European operetta interest in this sorts of things. But no, amazing voice. And again, just, you know, recently died two or so months ago. But real, real wide influence on the opera community.
Well, there it is. So we should probably talk about the difficulty you're having with Colline being in your group, because a lot of people may not know that we have reset the timing of La Boheme. We have moved it to the first Christmas after World War I.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about our particular setting and time have been, you know, moved a bit later in the time period, historical time period, to Paris, France, after the end of the First World War, and
the most glittering period of history in the world.
Yes,
it's years of astonishment.
Yes, culture and art. It's amazing upheaval politically, which produced an entirely new view of culture, and the people who embodied this landscape were people who were very personally affected by the tragedies of war. So in Colline in particular, in this realization of La Boheme is a blind character, and
because of the chlorine gas employed by the Germans, which blinded tens
many
of
people.
And the blind.
Permanently sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, permanently blinded, absolutely, yes. That was one of the great sorrows after the war. Mm-hmm. When people came home and they were all over London, there were blinded soldiers standing mm-hmm. there with a cup out because they didn't know what to do with themselves.
Yep, very, a time full of extremes. Yeah.
My favorite thing about the French in this particular case is that the guy who invented what we call Braille, that was his own name, just pronounced differently, was in 18th century France.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. by the time 20th century France comes along, it's absolutely standard mm-hmm. that you're going to be taught Braille instantly. And as soon as these guys came home from the war, they were instantly taught to read with Braille mm-hmm. and able to work into society much more quickly and easily than in other countries that mm-hmm. had not adopted it. That's like signing for the deaf also.
Yes.
It was mm-hmm. harder for them. The French have all seen to... You know, the French Revolution was very different because it was about the common man mm-hmm. against the overlords, right?
Yes, yeah, the nobility and aristocracy.
They had been bullied by the aristocracy and sucked dry. And suddenly, the France after the Revolution was about taking care of individuals throughout society.
Yeah.
So when I go visit my friends in France, I sit there in wonderment because as long as you want to go to college, you go to college and you pay no tuition.
Yeah, education and infrastructure are apparently some of the strongest things in France.
Child care, mm-hmm. care for the aged, medical care, completely mm-hmm. different from a whole different point of view. Mm-hmm. Whereas we look at medicine as a way for people to suck money out of the population.
Yeah.
They don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They look at and how many middlemen are there in medication now?
I mean, no, it's true. It's true. There's no national service.
There are three layers between me and my doctor. I'm paying mm-hmm. three different companies mm-hmm. before I finally pay my doctor. No wonder it's four mm-hmm. times as much. Right?
No,
because everybody's getting a cut.
It's definitely a different worldview of healthcare in France.
And in Germany and in England, well, I should say Great Britain, and mm-hmm. in Scandinavia.
Yeah.
So Scandinavia has an advantage. They have a small population and enormous oil fields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And the oil fields are owned by the government, not individuals. So the government is able to really take care of their people.
Yeah. No, it's better social policy in many ways.
Well, better is a strange word to use in this country. Mm-hmm. It's different.
Different social policy.
It's a different social policy.
Yeah.
And more care is taken of more people.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody helps to pay for it.
We
tried that in this country, and it's
harder.
We didn't really get it there, but it halfway prevailed in this recent mm-hmm. Vote in Congress for the American, what is it, the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that was good. But the French have a whole different point of view about what it is to be an individual and what are the rights of man.
Yeah.
What are the rights of individual human beings and health and security, mm-hmm. freedom from true want.
Yeah, that's something originating from the Bohemian idea and definitely starts in the Murger novelette.
Well, it's supported there. It begins mm-hmm. in the French Revolution.
Yeah.
It begins in the 18th
supported
century.
Supported there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's, other people agree with it too.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fun things about La Boheme is that rent is derived.
Well,
from
La Boheme. Yeah, and this is a moment in the novelette, and we have a landlord named Benoit, and he's a very he's manipulated by the Bohemians into avoiding. So
you,
we
you
avoid paying.
Me. I'm talking about the Broadway musical called Rent.
Oh, I absolutely did. I heard Rent is obviously, it makes it plain that it feels derivative of La Boheme, too.
Oh, yeah, they use the names and mm-hmm. everything, yeah, except Schaunard is Angel.
Interesting, yeah. You know, and after that time, I think there was a Boheme on Broadway.
Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons it's another the most performed opera in the world because they were, I don't know if there were seven or nine performances a week, every week for quite a while.
I met a man who did Rodolfo in that. He's a very remarkable singer. He's still singing right now. Amazing.
They had to use three of everything.
Yes.
Because you can't do
Rodolfo, three Mimi.
An opera singer cannot do what a Broadway show tune singer can do.
daily shows twice a day. Yeah.
Nine shows a week. They couldn't begin to think about it. So they had a cast of three. I think Eugene Brancoviano, who sings here, is very
good. Oh, really? He did that too?
I think he was a Marcello. I think so.
Wow.
So they need a lot of them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, it was cool. Phantom of the Opera also hired a whole bunch of sopranos and tenors because those two roles had to be sung by real opera singers.
I'd also heard that that particular production took as its setting 1950s America? Is that right?
No, it was more current. It was the AIDS epidemic America.
Oh,
1980s America.
Okay.
Because Mimi is a prostitute and has AIDS.
In La Bohème? In Baz Luhrmann's?
No, not Baz
Luhrmann's. Oh, in Rent. Okay.
In Rent. Yeah, oh, I'm right. Sorry. I didn't understand you
that
time.
No, it's fine. That's quite all right.
Yeah, Baz Luhrmann, Schaunard is called Angel, and he's a transvestite.
Wow!
A very flamboyant transvestite. And he dies of AIDS. He's the person who dies in the show. Mimi is a genuine prostitute, and she has HIV.
Wow.
So that's in Rent, which I've never seen, but now I kind of want to see it. I don't like that kind of music, you know? It's hard. I've been patient with it. Not enough ideas. It's not subtle. It's just not a lot of things I care about. But I think I need to watch Rent.
It's funny because I recently did a Bohème in Wichita, Kansas, having never been there. And one of the first things that some of the audience had mentioned to me was Rent. So it's not...
And you thought they were talking about Benoit.
No, yeah, right. No. They were great. They were really, really interesting and lovely people, and I enjoyed it very much there. But they had mentioned immediately this show, yeah.
Well, the Midwest knows about musicals.
Yeah, of course. And I guess must have many seen, seen it at the time.
During the time when all of us on the coasts, on both coasts, east and west, and the south, were suffering subscription declines, dangerous subscription declines, and a loss of single ticket sales, that was not true in the Midwest. Their subscriptions continued to grow.
Hmm.
The Midwest loves music.
Yeah.
And it's because of their school systems.
No, I can see that. I mean,
every child in every school studies music. There are choruses in all schools. Talk to Matt Hanscom sometime.
Yes.
They really get it.
And Matt is a singer from the Great North.
Yeah. He had voice lessons from a guy from St. Olaf's who came in to teach voice lessons in the high school. Mm-hmm. And he got out of chorus to have an hour lesson with this teacher once a week.
Arts and opera in Minnesota are huge. Yeah. And it's been that way at least since the famous opera director, Wesley Bach, was at Minnesota Opera in the 70s, 80s, I think. Yeah.
Well, I have a great deal. And they have symphonies. They have bands. Marching band is a huge thing.
Yeah.
They really have music in their lives. And we don't on the West Coast. We just don't have it.
It's not the same. Yeah, it's not the same.
Pop music reigns.
Yeah, and it's not used necessarily directly in education.
Precisely.
Yeah. Maybe indirect.
And did you know a person who attends a school that has music programs and is involved in the music programs is four times more likely to graduate than someone who doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
Four times more likely. If they play in the band or the orchestra or sing the chorus, they're four times more likely to graduate.
That was true for me. Yeah.
Being dyslexic, going to school for me was a pain.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I was dyslexic. My teachers didn't know. They didn't even know what it was, I'm sure. I certainly had never heard of it. And I just had lots of troubles academically. And if it weren't for chorus, drama, and creative writing, strangely enough, I would have dropped out of school.
No, no doubt, no doubt. I mean, these things, I'm amazed at the way, what we know about how we learn now, even compared to the way I grew up. I mean, we're talking about, 10, 20 years ago, it's just that level of speed in which, our knowledge of how we learn. It's just advanced a lot.
Rewiring the brain helps everything.
Yeah.
Gaining a new language helps everything. Helps everything about the way you learn.
Mm-hmm.
And singing and reading at the same time, lights up two different halves of the brain.
Yeah, a lot more by...
Because music is on one side.
Yes.
And text is on the other side.
Yeah.
So you're really creating fabulous neural networks that all get all connected up. So it's really great for the brain to learn to sing.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. And by the way, that's also why audiences who are attracted to opera like a lot of stimulation.
Yeah.
Because it's lighting up all parts of their... There's yep. the visual stuff that's going on. There's the aural stuff that's going on. There's the textual stuff that's going on. All that stuff is going on at one time. Mm-hmm. It's a huge dose of stimulation.
Yeah, and to render all that at the same time, it's I'm sure that's, you know, I enjoy such a thing. I mean,
just watching it
lights
up your brain, gives you brain mm-hmm. candy that you don't get anyplace else.
Yeah.
But for other people, it's overstimulation. They don't like it. They want to go to a ballet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where it's visual and music and that's all.
Yeah.
No text to mm-hmm. deal with.
Yeah, there's a simplicity to watching.
And then there are people who like musicals mm-hmm. where the music and text are delivered separately.
Mm-hmm.
By and large.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes in easier spoonfuls.
Mm-hmm.
It's this song now, that song then, easier mm-hmm. spoonfuls.
Yeah.
And the music isn't telling the story. The music is just dropped into here and there mm-hmm. during the course. Of course, that's changing. The American musical is pretty much sung through. Les Miserables is sung through. Mm-hmm. Sweeney Todd is sung through. So many mm-hmm. of them are sung through now. So they're copycatting what went on in yeah. opera.
Well, and soundtracked movies have changed a lot too. I mean, I think there was a big musical movie that won this year's Oscars.
La La Land.
I mean, yeah, I mean it's fantastic. You know, and
that's, well, it was,
you know,
really fun. I saw
that's,
it.
That's
with
a totally
friend, Emily.
You know, that's yeah. that's the definition of mixing genres. I think.
Well, we walked out of there all happy. The dancing was really bad, and the
I haven't
was,
seen it. I want to see it.
The story
later.
Is grand, and the cool thing they did at the end was give you alternate endings.
Wow! Yeah,
they just suddenly started right? playing like home movies of what their lives would have oh. been like had this not happened or had that not happened.
That's great.
And then you get brought back to the actual reality of how the show actually ends. But you see all these alternative endings, and it's mm-hmm. all done in a single decision to say a single thing.
Yes.
And that sets it off on a new path, and maybe not the happiest path of mm-hmm. all the possible choices.
Yeah.
So it's really, it's quite a wonderful movie, I thought, but they... 3 months to take people who don't dance and have them learn how to dance in 3 months. People who don't know how to sing and have them learn how to sing in 3 months.
With a guy that plays the piano.
Who had to learn how to yeah. play it in 3 months. And by the way, he did.
I know. That's the interview I saw about that. Yeah,
yeah. He actually he is sitting actually there playing the piano yeah. and playing it well. So I have a feeling he studied as a child. There's no way that he could have done that in 3 months' time. If he did, I want to find out who that teacher is. I'm going
what
down
a
there.
Style. Yeah. Yeah.
But what the cool thing about it was they hired such brilliant actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a difference.
Absolutely brilliant actors.
Yeah.
Who walk, march right into your heart, and you really care what happens to them next.
That's the key for all of these genres, I think. And the same with our show as well. I mean, it's about trying to develop the relationships between all of these characters. And from Colina to Mimi to Rodolfo to Schaunard to Marcello and Musetta, all the six principal characters. It's the space between the characters and their relationships to one another is what makes Poème still a memorable show.
I think it is the friendship.
Mm-hmm.
I a lot of operas end with somebody dying.
Yeah.
A lot
yeah.
of operas have boy meets girl.
That's not the That's remarkable not the thing about it. No,
the
it's
thing is the unique thing is the friendship between these young people.
Yeah.
That's the unique thing.
Yeah.
It's like I don't think anybody can copy it. Because it's like the Harry Potter movies or the Harry Potter books. You mm-hmm. can't copy that.
Yeah.
You just can't copy that. She did this unique and wonderful thing, and she's now the wealthiest author who ever lived.
Oh, the author of the Harry Potter. Yeah, I agree.
The wealthiest author who ever lived. She's just yep. the richest one of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fabulous. I really yeah. love that.
yeah.
Somebody who wrote books for kids.
But it's a real vogue for authors now, too. I mean, not just... Her name is J.K. Rowling, is that right?
Yeah, J.K. Yeah. Rowling. Yeah.
George R.R. Martin, right? He's the guy for Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Yeah
maybe not as unique. I haven't seen the show. I just know that, you know, there have been a lot of media attention.
I read those books.
Oh, yeah.
And not all of them. I read all but the last one,
mm-hmm.
at which point I picked them all off of my bookshelf and took them down to the used bookstore and said, you can have these, sell them to somebody else. Because it's just the same story over and over, just different characters going through the same crap. And
yeah.
boy, do they go through it. I can recommend that you watch at least the first episode,
uh-huh.
but do be ready. It's pornography, and it's really violent.
Yeah.
Did you see The Tudors?
Oh, yeah. Now that okay. I had seen, yeah.
That's pornography.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and
but it's
ways.
Not nearly so violent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's true.
So
yeah.
this is pornography, and it's very violent at the same time. It's mm-hmm. really a bloody time.
Wow.
The Middle Ages were bloody.
Yeah.
I'm reading History of England right now. I'm going to go on a tour of England. I leave on Christmas Day.
Really?
Yeah, this
oh,
is
that's
tour.
Excellent.
Yeah, this gal, she's actually Melita Thorpe. She runs a travel company. She takes tours for things to do with astronomy.
Wow.
All over the world. She's always somewhere in the world. And she said, don't you want to go on an opera tour? And I said, well, that would depend. She said, why don't we do an opera tour to New York? And I said, oh, I'd really rather not go to an opera tour to New York.
Mm-hmm.
She says, well, what would you like to do? And we started talking about Buenos Aires and, you know, Teatro Colón,
sure.
all these different things. And I said, does it have to be opera? Could we go on a theater tour to London?
No, oh, yeah.
She said, of course we could.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all set up.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's very cool. We fly out on the evening of Christmas, like 8 o'clock
oh,
at night,
great.
On Christmas Day, and we're going to see the Royal Shakespeare Company. There are many options.
Wow.
Julius Caesar is included in the tour. We'll be hearing concerts at Westminster Abbey and at St. Paul's Cathedral, I do believe. I'm not real mm-hmm. certain about that. And we'll be visiting Dickens' house and Handel's house, and Jimi Hendrix's house shares a wall with Handel's
mm-hmm.
house.
Yeah.
So it's
that's great.
Be, yeah, it's going to be totally fun. I'm totally excited.
There's a new show actually about English history on Starz. It's a follow up to The Hollow Crown, the one we were talking
oh, yeah.
about before. But there was one after that in 2014 called The White Queen.
Yes.
And I think now
oh,
they're
putting
up with
together
a new one about her daughter, the White Princess.
Yeah, there's actually going to be three of those.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, yeah. No, my wife and I were looking forward to seeing that too.
So that's fun. We have strayed off topics.
Of course.
Which is a
those
grand
are the
thing.
Best things. Well,
Kirk, I have to say, you have been a brilliant colleague.
It's my pleasure and
joy. Just a joy.
Well, thank you.
And I've watched you change over these 3 years with
you.
All these roles. And the thing that makes me know that your future is shining bright is how dedicated you are to the art.
Oh,
you
thank
just
you.
You live and breathe the art itself, and you arrive ready to rock.
Thanks.
There is no
thank you.
Stumbling around with you. You absolutely
I appreciate
don't.
That.
It's all thorough professional preparation.
Thank you.
And you don't get that even from great professionals all the time.
Oh,
you don't.
Thank you for saying
so
that.
It's marvelous. I, and the ease in your voice. I worry that the ease in your voice is robbing you of some excitement. Because it's just, I'm never
oh,
worried.
Oh, don't worry.
I'm never worried. It's just absolutely, no matter how hard it is, it just rolls
you.
Forth. You have figured out how to do
well,
it.
Well, I've been very lucky, and I'm very, very glad to have been working on so many great productions here. It's been my pleasure, and I always love to talk about art in all of its forms because it always informs opera.
Because opera
you.
Needs every bit of it.
It really does.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you for spending time with me, Kirk.
It's my pleasure, Larry.
Okay, bye-bye.